Blog Talk Radio.
Hello there, this is Fran Lewis. Yeah, I was here yesterday and I'm back again today. Ha ha, wouldn't you like to know? That is going to be so fantastic. We have two fantastic authors today on a show, but let me introduce myself. I'm your interviewer, talk show host, educator, reading and writing staff developer, and now I am the new Blog Talk Coordinator for Hillcrest Media. And I would like to introduce our first New York Times bestselling author, the author of The Bone House, which is really good, and the author of a brand new book, Spill Blood, which I think all teens need to read because after they read it, they'll understand why it's important to not leave a friend in trouble. So I would like to welcome Brian Friedman. Hi, Brian.
Hey, I'm happy to be here.
I am so honored to have you here, and I am really glad that I got to review your books. So could you give everyone like an overview or a short summary of Spill Blood is the new title, and tell them something about it?
Yeah, Spill Blood is my newest book. This is my seventh to be in stores. I can't believe we're already up to number seven in this amount of time. That's wonderful. Spill Blood is psychological suspense. That's the kind of book I write, and that means that it's intense drama that really emerges out of the emotions and the secrets and the backgrounds of the characters. I don't like to write about superheroes or supervillains. I like to take real flawed human characters and put them in situations where they're drawn across some terrible lines. And I think it's one of the reasons that readers can relate to these characters, because they're real people and they're characters where you want to put yourself in their shoes and say, you know, what would I have done if I were in that circumstance? So Spilled Blood takes the readers down to the rural lands of southwestern Minnesota, and it centers around this terrible feud that's going on between these two towns, where one town has an agribusiness company that has brought sort of wealth and jobs to this town, and the other smaller town downriver feels that this company has been poisoning them. And in the wake of that, there's litigation that fails, and it emerges into this terrible feud going on between the young people in both towns. And as such things go, sort of the origins of the feud quickly become lost, and it really becomes just about that self-perpetuating hatred and that violent tit-for-tat between the young people on both sides.
Yeah, this was really scary because this poor young girl was left out to die, literally. So when you restart the novel, how come you decided to a message from a person called Aquarius? Why did you decide to start it that way? Because I thought that was kind of unique.
Yeah, I always like to start the books with something that immediately has the reader wondering what's really going on here.
And I did.
So in this case, it's almost like a biblical message there. You've got someone that's talking about this feud going on and is sort of casting moral judgment on the towns, and it creates an overlay of sort of dread and anticipation that something truly awful is going to be happening before the end of the book, and it sort of leaves the reader in that immediate sense of anxiety about where is this going and what's out there that we don't know about yet.
I know, it sort of set the tone for the book, and it sort of said, like, oh my God, who is this guy? It was scary. Olivia Hawke and Tanya, what was their connection, and why were they out in the ghost town that night, and why did they hate Ashlyn so much, the poor thing?
Yeah, the book begins, the prologue begins with these three teenage girls, Olivia, Tanya, and Ashlyn, in a rural ghost town, and this kind of place actually exists in southwestern Minnesota. You have these wonderful old ghost towns that date back to the Depression era, and these crumbling bank buildings and desolate storefronts, and I can remember being down there in the early spring, and it was a very remote and bitter time of year, and I remember thinking, oh, this is just a wonderful, dramatic atmosphere, and I really wanted to set a book down there. So I actually had this vision of of the book beginning with these three girls in this ghost town, and I knew they were going to have a very volatile emotional confrontation, because two of the girls are from sort of one side of this feud, and the other girl is from the opposite side. In fact, Ashlyn is the daughter of the head of this company that sort of created all of these problems, and so they come together, and it sort of all of the frustration and loss and pain of the preceding years kind of bubble over into this feud between these girls, and by the morning, Ashlyn is dead, and the suspicion in everyone's minds is that Olivia Hawke was the one who killed her.
Yeah, but why? The fact that they hated her and they played a game of Russian roulette—that is scary. That was really scary.
You know, I have an odd debt of gratitude to of all people, Lady Gaga, because
I love Lady Gaga.
I know. Well, I was trying to, I was envisioning this confrontation in this ghost town, and I wasn't sure exactly what was going to be going on with these three girls, and I was driving around in my car one day, and a Lady Gaga song, Poker Face, came on the radio, and there's a line in that song that goes, Russian roulette is not the same without a gun, and I immediately thought, that's what's going on in this town. It's this terrible game of Russian roulette.
That's brilliant. Well, I love Lady Gaga. She's one of the tunes on my cell phone when people call. It depends on who you are as to what tune you get. My ringback tone.
Well, there are definitely some bad romances going on in this book. So.
Yeah, definitely bad romances going on in this book. But you know what gets me is that they didn't even hesitate to just leave the poor thing there. They just left her there, never figuring, I guess, that she was going to be dead the next day. So tell everybody about this research center that Ashlyn's father runs, Mundaman, and what were they supposed to be doing research for, or supposedly doing?
Yeah, you know, I used to work at a large corporate law firm, and so they had a lot of agribusiness clients around the Midwest, and so I had a chance to find out a little bit about what some of these companies do, and it's Mundaman, the company in the book is one of these sort of high-tech agricultural research centers that is doing a lot of things where they're snipping up strands of DNA and incorporating mm-hmm. pesticides into seeds and working with nanotechnologies, which are these nano-sized microscopic particles. And the theory, of course, is that in the end, these folks will sort of find a way to solve hunger and reduce the use mm-hmm. of pesticides by coming up with new innovative scientific techniques. Of course, the concern that other people have is that these folks are messing around with things that they don't completely understand, and that the results and the consequences could be very different and very tragic. So it's the kind of dispute and debate that is pretty topical these days. How much do you trust what these scientific innovations are bringing, and sort of where does your faith lie in what is being created in these labs?
It's scary because you really don't even know. You don't even know the medicines that you're taking and how safe they are either. And all this research that they're doing for all these other diseases too, it's frightening. But
scientists make some amazing discoveries, but scientists are also human, and they're subject to the same sort of arrogance and overconfidence that affects everyone else. So sometimes it can do wonderful things, and sometimes they can make some terrible mistakes.
Yeah, don't I know it? I spent 10 years watching my mother deteriorate from Alzheimer's, and I saw the different things they tried, and nothing. Well, there is no cure for that disease, so it just touching guard. It's scary. I mean, the research that came out in the hospitals that I called, and the clinical trials and everything, and they said that they did have stuff there, but for some reason, the FDA never wanted to approve any of that. So what bothers me too is that the adults were not the best in this town also, but the hate in both St. Croix and Barron spilled over to the kids. So why did the kids, the teens, decide that they couldn't get along with each other too? One side was rich, right, and the other side was the poor side of town, which in any place sometimes creates problems too. So why didn't
sure.
they stop them?
Yeah, that's one of the themes that I really wanted to bring out in this book is that hatred is hatred, and it sort of doesn't matter where it comes from. I mean, you can have you can have gangs battling each other in the heart of big cities, and you can have bitter feuds taking root in you know, these sort of idyllic small towns as well. And you know, the thing about teenagers as characters, they make wonderful characters in drama and suspense, because they have all of the, you know, all of the passions and hormones and emotions of adults, but they don't really have any of the experience and judgment and wisdom to bring to the table, and so they can be caught up in things that they don't completely understand, and find themselves making some terrible mistakes with often very good intentions.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I don't know if you saw it today. This is what brings to mind the hate and the horror that parents are not teaching their children respect of that poor person, the poor matron on the bus that was bullied by the students that were on the bus today, and she couldn't do anything about it. It was on the YouTube. It was on the Today Show today. This poor lady is 68 years old. She was the matron or the person that's supposed to be watching the kids, and they were totally abusive. So I think parents need to really take a harder look at what they're doing. So one side of the town, I said, was affluent. The other side was not. And this sort of set the stage for things. So the people in St. Croix, the kids in St. Croix, why were they the ones that were getting sick, whereas the other ones were not?
Yeah, and that's sort of the that's the question mark that everyone was facing in the book, is there was seemingly this cancer cluster in the town of St. Croix, and they had lost several young people in this very tiny town, and they immediately jumped to the conclusion that somehow this is connected to the pesticides or contamination that's coming out of this agribusiness company. Mm-hmm. Are they right? Are they not right? It's not clear in the beginning. And the thing about the thing about litigation in these matters is that it's usually very difficult to sort of prove causation. And you may think that something is happening, but actually having the evidence to prove it in court and prove it to scientific certainty is something else altogether. And the trouble is that when these people feel as if they have no remedy in the courts, the result can be sort of this explosion of emotion and frustration that takes them in very very dangerous directions.
And throughout this entire book, I'm just sitting here with my pen writing and adding things. Well, throughout the entire book, we hear from Aquarius taunting everybody, letting him know that he's watching and that he's going to come and take care of it.
Yeah, the that was the cool part of the book. he truly sort of hovers over the book, and while all of these things are going on, the feud continues, and Olivia's father's in town trying to defend her and prove that what happened in the ghost town that night was very different than what everyone believes. Sort of overlaying everything is the shadow of Aquarius, and again this sense that there is some cataclysm that is coming for these towns.
Yeah, but even when all is said and done, and I think I'm skipping ahead, no matter what happened to Ashlyn, Olivia left her there. So whether she's guilty or not, we're not going to say. But in a sense, it's still what happened, and she gets arrested for this thing. And her father's trying to defend her, and yet throughout the entire thing, I began to wonder, not at the toward the end, but I began to wonder, like, this kid needed to be taught more of a lesson than
something that Olivia's got to live with in this book is that kind of, that there are certain actions and certain mistakes that you can't correct, and that's why you have to be conscious of what you're doing and the choices you're making, because in many cases there's no going back on these choices, no matter how much you wish you could.
That's true. So I wonder if she had it to do over again, if she would have done it the same way, or actually if she's going to ever learn her lesson, or she would do it again, because some kids just never do. So you know what I mean? I mean, some kids just go ahead and do the same thing no matter what.
Yeah, well, and sadly, some adults do too.
we know that. We definitely know that. I know that's the scary part. But you know what? They don't learn to hate from nothing. They learn to hate from, there are people that are teaching them how to do this and how to be mean. And you don't have to be like other people. So who was Hannah, and why did she leave, and why did she return?
Well, the sort of family core of the book is the Hawk family, and Olivia is the daughter, and she lives in the town of St. Croix with her mother Hannah, Hannah is divorced from Olivia's father Chris, who still lives in the city in Minneapolis, and a few years earlier Hannah had gone back to her roots in this small town where she grew up, and took over the Women's Resource Center that her mother had launched in this rural community, and so Chris comes back to town not only to defend Olivia and to try to find out what really happened, but he's trying to see if there's still a future for himself and for Hannah, that he still regrets losing her, so for Chris this is sort of a journey of redemption, and it's an opportunity to see if in fact he can make amends for some of the mistakes of the past and build something new.
Well, just how many women are going to go backwards and take somebody back? That's pretty good.
You never know. And I think
you
one
never
of the
know
things
people,
about the,
right?
Yeah, and I think one of the things about the relationships, you know, in the book are that it's you know, Chris and Hannah have to sort of rediscover each other, and there's a lot of pain that obviously exists from the past that they need to get beyond, and yet you can tell right from the beginning there's still a lot of emotion there.
Well, I would imagine, and the fact that was Olivia close with her father, or she didn't see him that often?
You know, I think they did not see each other that often. I think Chris probably would have thought, you know, that he would have felt that he was close to his daughter, and yet it's certainly always true that you're never quite sure, you know, how well you know a teenager. And Chris begins to discover pretty quickly in the book that he was hearing what Olivia wanted him to hear. And when he gets to that jail cell and sees his daughter again, he realizes that this isn't a little girl anymore. This is a woman sitting there who has made some terrible mistakes, and there's a lot about her that he doesn't know yet that he has to discover.
Yeah, there are a lot of harsh realities that parents need to listen to. That's probably why all these YouTube and videos on and these things on Facebook. And I often wonder whether parents actually see what their kids are doing on Facebook, or if they even monitor it by having their own Facebook account. Well, I know my nieces are on Facebook, and they're 16, and their aunt knows everything they're doing because I go on Facebook. I'm always there with my reviews. So, and my niece, their mothers are constantly monitoring what they're doing. So if they happen to write something that isn't good, I know that they're going to get it. They're going to get answered. So parents need to be more vigilant, because these things happen every single day. And when you write something on Facebook and kids don't realize it, it stays with you forever. You could delete your account, but it's there forever and ever and ever.
No,
and
that's right.
And it's the new resume. It's the MySpace, Facebook, and Twitter, and I go on FriendFeed, that too, people, and Blurty, and all of them, and that's your new resume when you get older. You might think it's not, but when they put these nasty words or these dirty pictures or these, adults do it too, by the way, they're worse, and they'll write, the one thing you never should write on Facebook is, I'm going away on vacation and I'm not going to be home. That's
right, exactly. Yeah.
That's
yeah.
Why
I kind of think
someone,
that I'm waiting for Google and Facebook and these places to release their new privacy policy, which simply says you have no privacy. Get over it.
Yeah, I'm beginning to wonder about that. Yeah, I'm very careful. All I put on Facebook are my reviews and my links for my radio shows. That's about as far as I go. And if I happen to see on my cell phone that it's somebody's birthday, maybe I'll say happy birthday. But that's it.
Right.
I don't, you know, anything personal is not anybody's business. So this is about this research center, and a lawsuit was filed against them, right? What was the lawsuit, and why was it thrown out?
Yeah, and what happens is the families in St. Croix that have lost lost these young people in this cancer cluster, they file a wrongful death lawsuit against Mondawmin, the chemical company, and yet they're unable to establish a connection between what the company is doing and the actual illness that took these people, and that's often the case, I'm certainly not suggesting there are any easy answers, because you don't necessarily know what the the link is or isn't when it comes to these kinds of situations. At the same time, for the people in the town, all they know is that they've lost something precious, and particularly for the young people and their friends, they want to strike back at someone, and they want someone to be punished for what happened, and that's how everything bad starts to happen.
I know, and people don't often sit down and take stock and think about what they're doing before they do it. They just sort of, it's almost like a vigilante kind of thing.
That's exactly right.
That's what gets me. It's almost like a vigilante kind of thing that people just decide they're going to take it into their own hands and not realize that maybe one of them will be next. You know, you just don't know.
Yep,
so
that's right.
In this, they're using technology to enhance foods, and that's why a lot of people eat organic because it's safer. So why are there pesticides often used, and how dangerous are they? And should we really be eating things that have pesticides? Of course not. You can't prove it. And that's why when you get a fruit or something like that, you should wash it off thoroughly before you eat it. What's the difference between that and organic?
Well, and of course, I'm not a scientist. I'm just a thriller writer. So I certainly don't have any of the answers when it comes to those kinds of things. What I like to do is raise the questions and put them in front of readers and recognize that everybody's going to have to come down and make their own choices on these things. But most of the time, the issues are pretty complex, and there's no black and white on either side. But those are the things that we face when it comes to, you know, sort of scientific progress, in quotes, is what's progress and what's not.
I often wonder whether the FDA really checks out everything, and just how thorough they are in food and agriculture. I often wonder how thorough they are too, because you just never know, you know, when the salmon's going to be good or when the chicken's going to be bad. You know, you just get a bad. Yeah,
right.
I know.
Right.
I
yeah,
know.
Yeah.
I'm on a health kick, and I'm really.
When you can get salmonella from spinach, you know, you just,
yeah, that's scary.
you never know what's going to be out there.
I know, and that's one of my pig out foods, that and grapefruit, because I don't pig out on cake or anything like that, because I lost a ton of weight and never gained it back. So to me, you know, when you take away my salmon or my chicken or my, you know, turkey, I'm in big trouble.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And I think there was the other thing that was recently melon, was honeydew, not honeydew, cantaloupe, and people were getting sick from, people got sick from cantaloupe, so that went my fruit salad, and I am on a health kick. I don't need anything that's fried, eggs, red meat, or butter ever. So it's really hard, and it's like, okay, I can't have my melon. But, as long as I have my grapefruit, I'm a happy girl. But people need to be really careful. You just don't know. And there are so many different markets out there that you have to really pick and choose which one you go to.
Sure.
Seriously. So what was finally revealed about the research center, and who was Julia Steele?
Well, Julia is the wife of Florian Steele, who's the head of Mundaman, the company, and of course they're the parents of Ashlyn, the girl that is murdered in this ghost town. And Julia and Florian have a number of scenes together in the book, and you can see the strains in their relationship, and you can see the extent to which Ashlyn was keeping secrets from them, and Julia wasn't sure what she knew or did not know about what her daughter was really doing, and ultimately she's afraid on some level that all of what's happening is sort of punishment for things that have been going on at Mundaman. And I won't say anything beyond that, but they certainly get caught up in everything that's going on, and certainly Aquarius has them very much in his sights.
Yeah, Aquarius has everybody in his sights. As long as he doesn't have us in his sights, we're in good shape here. And considering I'm a Virgo, I'm going to stay away from him. But, this is why I'm saying that parents really need to be focused on what their kids are doing. And they need to, you know, when a parent says to you, call when you get there, or please, you know, give me your cell phone number, or when you get to a friend's house, what time are you going to be home? They're not spying on you, people. They're just trying to keep you safe.
Right.
And
right.
I know how to do that for 100 years. Even when my mother died last year, she would look at me and go, okay, Mom, I'll call the aide and tell her where I'm going. No problem. But the parents are not spying on you. If you go somewhere, you shouldn't go by yourself. You should always go with a friend. Mm-hmm. And, of course, if you say you're going somewhere and you're not there, then and you wind up somewhere else, then it's your own problem, your fault. So I have another question here. Why didn't anyone believe that Olivia was not guilty? I mean, she actually was pointed straight at her, yet no one believed her. And why did the county attorney tell Chris so much? Why was he so forthcoming with him?
You know, I think it is awfully easy. It's awfully easy for people to sort of assume the worst, and I think there's just this natural tendency. And I think it may be particularly true in here. You've got the small towns, and you've got this terrible feud going on. That it's easy to leap to conclusions about what's really happening, and so all of the evidence that they gather seems to point to the one explanation that Olivia killed Ashlyn in this game of Russian roulette, and that's what the police find, and that's what people think, and they don't necessarily go looking for alternative possibilities. They're thinking that what they see is what's in front of their face, and that is that Olivia is guilty. And once people have it in their heads that someone is guilty of something, it's awfully hard to dislodge that from their heads. But Chris Hawk comes to town, and this is his daughter, and he's got to struggle with, does he believe her, and does he believe Olivia when she says that she did not pull the trigger, and something else was going on in the town that night, and so he sort of finds himself facing an uphill battle against all of the belief in that town that his daughter did what they say she did.
Well, you know what the problem is, too? I wonder, in real life, because you're an attorney, do the courts really, do the police, just when they find somebody, do they look to see if there maybe someone else did it? Or once they get their mind that this person is guilty, that's it? They don't go to find anybody else?
Well, you know, the police do wonderful jobs, but of course, you know, the reality of police work is very different from what people see on TV, and
I would imagine.
You know, there's sort of an assumption these days because of people watching shows like CSI and other things like that that all these cases are you know, decided by, you know, DNA and other kinds of absolute evidence like that. And you know, the reality is in most cases that's not what things turn on, and it's a question of dealing with circumstantial evidence and eyewitnesses and all of those things are harder to prove with certainty, and these days they even talk about the fact that there's sort of a CSI effect with juries, that people now expect to have this very concrete scientific evidence laid in front of them, and for most cases, that's not there, and so these kinds of investigations still rely on a lot of the old-fashioned investigative techniques more often than not.
And the young cops that come in today, do they take the time to do that, or is it the more seasoned ones that will go and look that one step further? I mean, sometimes you get a police officer or maybe even a district attorney or someone like this one and says, I'm not sure if she really did it. I have to prove that they didn't. And yet they want to win the case anyway. So how many district attorneys would actually turn around and say to themselves, maybe not out loud, this person didn't do it, I have to see who else did it, rather than worry about winning the case?
Yeah, that's a tough question because, you know, it's always nice to think that that you know justice is blind, often it is not, and in a lot of cases it's being driven by you know, media pressure and pressure from the public and politics and a lot of other things, and the result is sometimes that justice gets rushed, and fast justice is not necessarily true justice.
So then the wrong person can actually go to jail. So I wonder how many times the poor person that's in jail gets is there for so many years and nobody bothers to even help them. And it's a matter of also money, isn't it? Whether they can afford to get somebody to actually listen. You know,
sure, yeah. No, that's right.
It's scary. That's why people need to do the right thing and not get in trouble. But that's not going to happen.
Until human nature changes a lot, I think we're still going to have the justice system.
You know what gets me is that there are so many crime scene programs and so many murder books and murder suspense, but some of the suspense books that I read are so graphic and they describe how to make a bomb and how to poison someone that I often wonder that, you know, do you really want to put that in a book to teach people how to do what we're trying to teach them not to do? So I often wonder sometimes if kids read, you know, books or adults read books and then they go out and do what the book said. Of course, they're going to get caught because they're not in the book. I mean, how do you think that what's written in a suspense book or in a murder book affects what other people do in real life? And just how much information should we give people?
Yeah. You know, that's a tough moral judgment. I mean, how responsible are you if people take your words and you know, twist them and do something bad with them? That's a tough call. You know, I know for me, you know, I look at some of the books these days, and what concerns me is the use of a very graphic and explicit violence in the books.
Yeah.
I find that unnecessary and gratuitous, and I just don't like it. I sort of prefer the, you know, my books are very intense and sometimes very scary, but I tend to steer clear of you know, very explicit violence, and I sort of prefer the Steven Spielberg approach, where a lot of the fear is being created in your own mind because you're imagining what's going on. You're not necessarily seeing it on the page.
I agree with you because I've read almost 700 books in the last 2 years that I've been reviewing them, and sometimes I actually have to hide under the covers while I'm reading them because some of them are so graphic and so scary, and I start out reading this and I'm going like, why did I say I would read this and review it? This
right.
is scaring the day. And of course I'll review it and I'll do a good job, but I don't want to. I'll just bury it afterwards. I'll take the book and like, okay, bye. because some of it, I often wonder, and I read a lot of YA books too, and
sure.
I don't read vampires and stuff, but I did read Patty Briggs' Fair Game. It was excellent. That I have to say was really good. But sometimes I really begin to wonder some of the stuff that they write for teenagers to read also is also teaching them, sending them the wrong message.
Yeah, boy, a lot of the YA stuff is pretty bleak and violent these days. So.
Yeah, I know. I have two nieces and two nephews that are teenagers, and the girls don't read anything violent, but the boys do. And I often wonder, you know,
yes,
just
well,
how much they're learning.
Boys, that is certainly true. Yeah.
my two nephews are amazing, but yeah, I begin to wonder, like, what are you reading? And
well, be glad they're reading at least. That is a good thing. So.
They do. It's a requirement. Like I said, my mom used to make me read 6 to 8 books a week and take notes, and my brother is not anywhere. He's worse. So yeah, my nephews have to read a lot, and they pretty much know what they're reading. They'll read just about anything in any series that's out there for teens. But when they need, help or, with a classic or something, they know who to call over here and say, did you read this and can you help me? So I do know that, if you think about it, my favorite book in the whole world is Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And that is not exactly, that's like, I love that book. And that said, violence in it, too, is teaching kids how to change from one person to another and double personality. So it's not like the classics don't have that also. So the crime scene with this murder case, how do you sanitize a crime scene so well that no one knows what happened? There was not a drop of DNA. That was absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, that is the thing about these about sort of crime scenes in the real world is that there's sort of this expectation from TV and the movies that they're finding all this wonderful DNA evidence that's revealing everything. Yeah, in most modern crimes, that's not necessarily the way it goes.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot harder to gather these things than people realize, mm-hmm. and particularly in some of these rural areas, the police forces, often are not going to be equipped with the kind of, technology and resources necessary to really preserve and collect this material from a crime scene. So more often than not, they're going to be looking at more old-fashioned ways. And in the case of this case, it seems pretty clear to the police from the beginning that they know what happened, and so they're not necessarily looking for a for a different explanation, because it seems pretty clear from the get-go what happened in the town that night. And it's really only Chris Hawk that comes to town and says, not so fast. This isn't what people think.
Yeah, I know. That's a sad part. And a lot of these small towns are not trained to do this stuff either. You're right. So the crime
scene
gets contaminated. But you would think
I mean, so often you look at the big unsolved crimes, and a lot of cases, what happens is you've got crimes happening in these small towns that just don't have murders happening very often, and it's very easy to sort of permanently destroy a crime scene to a point where you never really can to get the evidence that you need.
And that's sad, because then somebody's going to get away with murder. Unless somebody's really smart. That's what's really scary. I know. And then, you know, you're supposed to be innocent until proven guilty, but I doubt that a lot of times. Sometimes when you're just, even if you aren't guilty, sometimes it doesn't even matter. Once you're in jail, it's sort of like, okay, that's it. So you have
it's usually pretty easy for suspicion to fall on people's heads. And the hard part is every time people sort of leap to a conclusion, some case comes up that shows there are always other possibilities. I mean, I think these days the sad fact about most child disappearances is that people sort of look at it and immediately leap to the conclusion that the parents were involved, because there have been so many cases where a parent was involved in some terrible crime like that. And yet then you had the case in Utah with Elizabeth Smart, where the child disappeared, and again there was a lot of suspicion that fell on the heads of the parents, only to discover it was exactly what they had claimed from the beginning, which was that a stranger had abducted her. And so it's awfully easy to believe that you know the truth, and often reality can be a lot more complicated.
It's scary. My mom had Alzheimer's, like you said, and about a couple of years ago, the aide comes to my house and she says to me, "Your mother's missing," and that's scary. So I go to her, I go, "Now, how can my mom be missing?" She was missing. She says, "Well, I left her outside so I could go shopping. When I came out, she wasn't there." I said, "Now, that's crime." I said, "And you literally lost my mother, and someone could have kidnapped her. And I don't know where my mother is." And she just looked at me, and she said, "Well, I had to go shopping and buy this to my daughter. I guess you're going to find her." I said, "I guess you're going to have more than just a small problem." And it turned out that my mother was picked up by a strange man.
Oh, geez.
And she was in a wheelchair and she had Alzheimer's. And she said, "I can't find my girl." And instead of describing what the girl was wearing, she was describing what she thought I was wearing. And this guy, we were just very lucky, because it was 105 degrees, and he took her to the local hospital. Who knew her never called me, and I called there, and they told me she was there. And when I got there, she looked at me and she says, "I figured you'd figure it out eventually." Now that was in like the middle stages of Alzheimer's, and I said to the police, because I did call them, I said, "This is inexcusable. How do you leave somebody? She could have been dead." And the guy said to me, he said, "Well, I saw her by herself." So I mean, it could happen to older people, it could happen to younger people, and you just don't.
No, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
And this is the Bronx. What can I say? So, is there such a thing? And I've always wondered. I know you have these, throwaway phones and stuff like that, but how can a phone be untraceable? How can you have a phone that no one can trace?
Yeah, a phone's not necessarily untraceable, but you can't necessarily connect it up to anyone. I mean, you can walk into, Target or Best Buy and buy one of these pay-as-you-go phones, and the phone itself is not untraceable, but there may not be any connection to who actually purchased it and is using it. So it's frankly, there are cell phones that are stolen all the time and then resold on eBay and things like that, and a lot of the cheap phones that end up for sale on some of these used sites are actually stolen phones. So what you're finding now is the cell phone companies are trying to sort of team up to find ways to make these phones unusable when they're stolen. But for the time being, anyway, it's still unfortunately fairly easy to have a phone that is not really connected to whoever's using it.
so when you go into, I've never bought one of these prepaid phones, so that when you go in to buy a prepaid phone in any one of these, you know, stores or bodegas or anything, because I know they sell them there too, no one asks anybody for proof. You just buy the phone and you buy the minutes.
No. Yeah, exactly. I mean, like when we're over in London, we'll just buy what they call a top-up card, where you actually are buying a SIM card. You plug into a phone, and at that point, you know, you pay £5 cash to get a card, and you plug in the SIM card, and you're good to go, and you can use the phone for whatever credit is on that card. But all you did was walk in and hand them a £5 note, and you're on your way.
So kids could do that also? Children could
do
that also?
Yeah.
That's kind of dangerous, because then that's what you get. These people that call in and they threatening phone calls and all sorts of stuff like that. So they actually can trace it, and from a cell phone tower, they can't trace those either.
Yeah, they can trace, they can find
trace
out
the
phone probably,
move.
But they can't necessarily figure out who's using it. So,
well, they supposedly they can triangulate and find out where the person is, but by that time they threw the phone away, so it doesn't matter. It's too
right.
So we have another character.
It was still a lot easier for crime writers before DNA and cell phones and all these things. It was easier in the old days when it was it is harder to get away with crimes these days. You have the crime writer has to work particularly hard to keep that mystery going.
Well, Perry Mason seemed to be able to figure him out, and Poirot, he's my favorite crime detective. He actually deduced every little step of the way, and you just didn't know who was going to do it at the end, and you thought he didn't get it, but he did. And Perry Mason won every single case. He never lost. It was the one that he lost.
One he lost, right? That's still a pretty good record.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was a little kind of like, how does Perry Mason not lose a case? But, you know, he's the lawyer that you definitely won on your case, somebody like that.
That's right.
I know, but him or Andy Griffith, Matlock.
One or the other, right?
So who was Glenn, and tell me so, who was Glenn, and Tanya was there that night, but they didn't seem to link her up to it right away.
Well, Tanya was there that night, but then she was the third girl in the ghost town, and and she ran away before anything happened. So she didn't really see what actually went on between Olivia and Ashlyn, but of course was sort of leaping to the obvious conclusion along with everyone else that clearly it must have been Olivia. And Glenn Magnus is the minister in the small town of St. Croix who actually had lost a child as part of this cancer cluster, and he is good friends with Hannah Hawk in town, and his son Johan is sort of at the root of some of the emotional issues that are going on between Olivia and Ashlyn, and yet Johan is he's an example of how things get out of control, because he's at heart a moral, religious, and well-intentioned teenage boy, and yet as the novel progresses, he too gets drawn across some terrible lines and begins to feel as if there's no way to get justice except for violent ways, and it nearly leads to disaster.
Well, I'm not going to give away the ending. I just crossed out two questions because that would kill it. So if you could address teenagers today, what would be the message they gave? Because before we have another 15 minutes, I do want to get into talking a little bit about the Bone House, because that scared me too. that was really good, and I want to know what you're writing next, because I have to get it first. so what would you hope that the people in this town learned at the end?
I hope that in the end they're able to bury the hatred between the towns and recognize that the violence between them has solved nothing, and what they need to do is talk more and shout less, and I think that's probably something we could all afford to learn these days.
Yeah, I think people need to actually learn to listen. that was something that I tried to explain to one of my relatives when they were raising their voice to a child. And I said, kids are going to say things they're not, you're not going to like the language that they use all the time, but you need to let them say it the way they have to say it. I guess as an educator for 100 years, I'm just, you know, I know how to work with tough kids. And I was the dean, and I'm little, and I walked into a room and everybody listened. It's amazing. It's all in how you present it and how you say it.
Right.
But you need to listen. Even when two kids came in and they had a fight, and little me was like brave enough to separate them because that was my job. you have to listen. Yeah, I got hurt a lot. Not because they wanted to hurt me, but because I didn't let anybody hurt anybody else. And they knew, don't mess with this little girl. This her. She may be little, but she's tough. But you got to listen. Yeah, let me tell you.
Yep.
But parents need to listen to what their kids are saying. And sometimes they have to look past what they really think happened and find out what really did happen. And
right,
in this
right.
particular case, I guess maybe if Ashlyn's parents were bothering to listen and paying closer attention to her, maybe this would not have happened. You know,
right,
you just don't
right.
know. So let's talk about the Bone House for a minute. But what's your next project? Because I need to have it first.
Yeah, no, my first five books were part of a series that all featured a Duluth police lieutenant named Jonathan Stride, and I put Stride through such hell in those first five books that after book five, The Burying Place, which was actually a finalist for best novel in the International Thriller Writer Awards, I decided Stride needed a break, so I've done two standalones, The Bone House and Spilled Blood, but Stride is coming back, so the new Stride novel is done, and that will be out next year, so that will be my next book.
Oh, okay. Well, you have to make sure that I get it next year. But
absolutely.
I want to read the other ones. But somehow you got to get me the other ones so I can read them.
That's true. Even yeah, because you want to start with those. So absolutely.
You need to send me those. I need to start with those because otherwise, I have to. I'm going to only ask the questions on the show anyway. Like, you know, all about them. So yeah, I have to get it first. Yeah. I think that the biggest honor I had 2 weeks ago was an author of The Road to Amelis, and she just wrote Sapphire Trails, asked me to do her back cover, and I go like, okay. And it takes a while just to know what the right thing to say because everybody wants something different, so I got all excited. I can't wait to see it.
That's
because
great.
How
That's
often
great.
Do you get a chance to, this is like the fourth time somebody asked me to do a back cover, but this is like the whole back cover. It's like, okay, I can.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, that's wonderful.
Yeah, yeah, I'm getting good at this. So tell everybody about The Bone House. And
well, the Bone House, that was my last book, and it started as a standalone, although there's a character in The Bone House, Cab Bolton, who's a Florida detective who's actually going to be coming back in my next book, the one that I'm
starting.
Oh,
I was
going to
ask that question too.
Summer. Yeah, Cab will be returning, so I'll sort of have a couple parallel series going. But The Bone House, it really revolves around this married couple, Mark and Hillary Bradley, and Mark Bradley is accused in this terrible crime where a teenage girl is murdered, and Hillary, his wife, is the one that continues to believe in him and have faith in him, even when a lot of people around her are telling her that her husband is a monster. And she ends up teaming up with Cab, this kind of quirky Florida detective, to find out what was going on in this young girl's life. And the original kernel of inspiration behind The Bone House was actually the Natalie Holloway case in Aruba,
oh.
where that teenage girl disappeared. And as often is the case with some of my books, I may be inspired by a true crime, and then I start playing with the circumstances and thinking, sort of playing what-if games with the crimes. And I thought about that case down in Aruba, and I was thinking, you know, what if you found out that this teenage girl that disappeared years earlier had been a witness to a terrible crime that was unsolved? Would that suddenly make you think that something different was going on there? And so that was how the sort of basic twist of The Bone House got started.
Yeah, that is really, that was a real, and the scenes and the backlashes and the flashbacks, whoa. So why did you decide on a wrongly accused teacher? I'm an educator, what can I say?
Yeah. Well, you know, in fact, we had a couple dear friends of ours that had gone through some unfortunate circumstances where the husband was a teacher and was mm-hmm. You know, was suspected of some inappropriate behavior that he was not mm-hmm. guilty of, and yet it's the way those things often work that in many cases all it takes is the accusation to start right. raising doubts in people's heads, and so that was one of the themes that I really wanted to work with in this book, was that concept of doubt and faith and trust, and how do you really know the person that you're sleeping next to.
I agree with you. I understand that. The second story in the book I just came out with, Faces Behind the Stone, the second story was told to me before my friend died. She was wrongly accused and placed in the rubber room. And that second story is exactly what happened to her right before she died, as she dictated it. You know, what happened when she was accused of doing something that she actually would never do. So,
right,
you know,
right.
And the scary part with educators is that you're taken out of the classroom, you're put in a situation. These rubber rooms are horrible, where you just sit there and told to do nothing or just read a book all day long. It made you feel like you're a criminal, and you're sent there every single day, whether you're guilty or not, automatically
yeah.
guilty no matter what. That's the scary part with an educator, because you don't get the same kind of, you get the same due process, but not really, that everybody
right,
else gets.
Right, right. Well, and you know, these days I think that more and more young people have begun to realize the power that these kinds of accusations hold, and sometimes end up wielding it without really understanding the truly serious nature of the consequences.
Well, some of them do it when they don't get a good grade, and they figure, well, I'm
right,
the teacher
yeah.
in trouble, or you get these young girls that think the teacher is cute, because I've seen that too. And he, you know, doesn't.
Yeah, and in the case of the Bone House, you had this this girl Teresa that essentially sort of, you know, fell in love with Mark Bradley and had spun
yeah.
out this fantasy life involving him, and then when her mother discovered these things that she'd written, leaped to the conclusion that this was real, not fictional, and that there was really this affair going on between Mark Bradley and her daughter, and that was what. You know, resulted in him losing his job and sort of set the wheels in motion in terms of him being perceived by the community as a predator. So when Teresa's sister is mm. murdered, all of the suspicion in the town sort of falls immediately onto Mark Bradley's head.
That's what's really scary, guilt by just because you said it. And,
right.
I mean, it's the same thing with child abuse, too. I mean, a parent could not have done something and a child is mad at them and they just say, well, my mother beat me up, so I'm all purple. And
yeah.
you got to really be careful. Some parents are abusive because, like I said, dealt with it for so many years. And unfortunately, I'm never wrong. I was never wrong. And that's the sad part. You're best reporting it, then whatever. So let me ask you one or two more questions, and then where can everyone get all of your books?
Yeah, all of my books. You know, the easiest way is to get them online, or mm-hmm. they can also, you know, if they're not at their local bookseller, their bookseller can always order them in. But if they go to my website, it's www.bfreemanbooks.com. That's all one word, bfreemanbooks.com. There's information on all of my books, excerpts from all of them, and links to places where they can buy them as well. So they can get all sorts of information about me and my books and all of that at bfreemanbooks.com.
Well, I'm going to have to reschedule you for another show so I could talk more about the Bone House.
Absolutely. Well, I would be delighted to come back.
That would be good, because I'm going to pin you down. I actually have a date. I can actually do, I'm not sure about the time, I can do August 16th or August 17th. Are you free then? Any one of those days?
You know, I'll have to check my calendar, but I'll check it and I will let you know, because I'd certainly
let
love
me
to,
know, because
love
I would
talk
really
more about
like
the Bone
to
House.
Do that.
We've got a lot to cover there.
I have all these questions that I didn't get to, and I really want to get to them. So I can do August 16th at 3 p.m. or August 17th, either at 3 or 4, depending on whether Iris Johansson is taking 3 or 4 that day. I'm not sure.
Sure. Well, so I don't want to step on Iris's toes. So.
Yeah, neither do I. No, but I'll give you the time once I know which day she's taking, because I'm not sure yet. But
perfect.
If you can do either one of those dates, just let me know.
I will do that.
thank you so much, Brian. I appreciate it. And
thanks
I
so much,
like
Fran. It was a pleasure to talk to you, and I'll make sure all the books keep rolling your way so that you can enjoy them.
Please send me the other five because, you know, after all, I'll just move them to the top of my list.
Very
and
good.
I would like to welcome Robert Degoni, the author of Conviction. Hi, Robert. How are you?
Fran, I'm well. How are you? I was just enjoying your interview. It was very interesting.
Thank you. Yeah, the Bone House is really, really good. And we were talking about lawyers and police officers and how they handle cases. And do people actually look past, you know, with a person that's guilty? And you're a lawyer too, right?
I am.
That's why this is right up your alley.
It's very interesting. I have to get a copy.
The Conviction, Bone House is really great, and Spill Blood about the town. Oh my God, it's really scary. I mean, it's really great, but we're gonna talk more about the Bone House if Brian can come back on the show, because we were focusing on his new book. But your book scared me. It was one of those books that I was reading, and I'm saying I got to stop reading this because it was really like, why did you decide to write The Conviction?
You know, it's really funny. The reviews have said similar things. I got an AP review that loved it and talked about it being a book that every parent and child should read together.
Yeah, I agree.
I just got a review in Houston, said the same thing. Bookreporter.com, same thing. And that's what people are really picking up on, is the mm-hmm. importance of the father-son relationship in this book, because you know, because it really, when that relationship broke down, that's what set Jake, Sloan's stepson, off on a problem. And I have to be perfectly honest with you, this book for me was a complete guilty pleasure. I wanted to write a book like The Jury Master, in which I wanted it to have a lot of action. I wanted it to have a lot of thrills. I wanted to have some scenes that were scary for people. And I really wasn't focusing so much on the issue of the privatization of for-profit detention facilities. It certainly is an issue in my book, and I always write about issues, and I wasn't focusing so much on this idea that, you know, how important it is for parents to remain in touch with their kids, because it takes one mm-hmm. stupid mistake for a kid to end up in jail, and then what do you do? I was just really focusing on trying to write an exciting page-turning book.
Well, you got all of what you just said and more. Because basically it was a page-turning book with a whole bunch of lessons. So for those parents out there that listen to this after or during, if you've got a teen that's, you know, going in the wrong direction, you might want them to read this because they'll go back in the right direction. I could tell you that.
Yeah, my son is 15, and he's reading it, and he's Facebooking all his friends, and you know, we talk about that. I talk about that with my children. I say it takes a lifetime to build a reputation and one dumb moment to tear it down.
Exactly. I mean, and Facebook is a great social outlet, but you got to be careful what you write on Facebook, because we were just saying it before. That is your new resume, and people are going to, you can delete your account, but it's there. And
yeah.
When kids write all of these threatening things, and they do, and the cyberbullying and all of that, they don't realize, I mean, just that incident today that I was watching on the Today Show, that poor matron on the bus that was taunted by all those kids. That was horrible. And what Matt Lauer finally said, he was right. He says, I wish I could have a picture of every one of those kids, show their pictures and their addresses, and I think that everybody needs to know who they are, because what they did was monstrous. It was horrible to torment that 68-year-old lady. And what bothered me was that I couldn't understand why she couldn't stop them. She couldn't say anything. She was told not to say anything. I mean, me as an educator and as a dean, there would be no way that I would not, you know, do something. I'm surprised she didn't take her camera and just snap them as they were doing, you know, this with her cell phone.
Yeah.
So how did you create, this is based on a real case, right? This book is based on something that really happened.
It is. It's based loosely on events that took place in Pennsylvania. Where you had two judges. One was pled guilty, and the other, I believe, has been either indicted and convicted or is in the process of the legal system, where after 3 years, they found out that these guys had influenced the county supervisors that the detention facility that they had was outdated and that they needed to build a new one. And so a developer built a private detention facility, received, you know, a huge amount of money from the county to lease it, free land, and he built this this private for-profit detention facility, and then lo and behold, they found out that these two judges were also sentencing kids to this facility, that the sentences were longer and more stringent than their counterparts in any other area of the state, and further investigation revealed that these judges were getting kickbacks. They were making money off of it. And so that was sort of the impetus for the idea that, you know, I wanted this book to be Jake's book, because really what I did was I set this up in bodily harm. I wrote bodily harm, and I did something in bodily harm that that I knew was going to be controversial, but that I knew would allow me to write the next four Sloan novels. And it allowed me to write Murder One, and because of what happened in that book with, you know, Tina dying, it allowed me to write this book, The Conviction, because one of the things I said to myself is, what does it do to a 15-year-old boy to watch his mother be killed like that? And what it did, obviously, was Jake begins to rebel. He begins to rebel against, you know, authority about what's going on. He gets kind of down a black hole with respect to alcohol and drugs. And it's a tough situation because, you know, David Sloan is a fixer. David Sloan, my protagonist, is the guy that can fix anything. He's the lawyer who doesn't lose. And this is a situation where he comes in and his son looks at him and says, I don't want your help. You know, I don't want your help. You weren't there for me when I needed you. Don't try to come in now and do it. And it, you know, it's such a poignant issue for any parent, because so many parents that, you know, you talk to and that you deal with will tell you that they've had that situation at one time or another in their life, where all they want to do is help their kids, and their kids tell them they don't want their help. They don't want it. And, you know, so for Sloan, he has that to deal with. He can't be the knight in shining armor. And then the second thing he has to deal with is he finds a judicial system that's corrupt, and that he can't use. I mean, normally he walks into a courtroom and he can solve it. And he's told very early on by his mentor, or this priest in the book, that this is not a situation you're going to be able to fix in a courtroom. And that's what I really wanted to do, was make him realize that repairing his relationship with Jake is going to require a lot more effort than just walking into a courtroom and trying to fix it. And that's why I took that comfort zone away from him. I made it purposeful that the judicial system betrays him and the law has abandoned him, and he's got to figure out another way to do this.
It's more like real life, yeah. It wasn't like every step of the way he was going to. They stopped him every step of the way, and they even attacked him a couple of times, too.
The reviews have been really, really spectacular, but there was one review by a, you know, pretty well-known service that one of the things they said at the end was, you know, it's sort of along the veins of, you know, that it's not plausible because Sloan is so well-connected, he would have just gone and gotten help. And I laughed when I read it because, you know, for me, it was sort of one of those reviews where you kind of ask yourself, did they read the book? Because how? I mean, that was my whole point, is where do you go when your child is sentenced, convicted in the judicial system, right? Where do you go? You have to go through the judicial system. I don't care who you are or how powerful you are. You can't just walk someplace and say, hey, free my son. And that's why I really, really did not want this to be a situation where Jake was convicted for stealing a pack of bubble gum. I mean, the crime that he commits is a real serious crime. He steals alcohol, he breaks into a place, he steals alcohol, he steals a rifle, and he's out, you know, getting jolly good ripped and firing off a gun in an area where there's, you know, potential houses and people. This was a serious crime, so that, you know, I wanted it to be a serious crime so that Sloan couldn't just, you know, go to anybody. I don't know who he'd even go to and say, hey, you know, this is ridiculous. This is obviously, you know, a sentence that should not have been handed down. I wanted it to be one of those sentences where, you know, yeah, you could see it being very plausible that he'd be sent away for what he did.
Yeah, but they also tricked Jake and his friend and Tom. When they went there, they said, well, you should tell us what happened. They also tricked him. So they were victims as well of the judicial system, because they tried to make them say, well, you know what, if you tell us the truth, nothing's going to happen, or it's going to be bad, whatever. And then they wound up telling the truth in this particular case was the wrong thing to do.
Right. No, absolutely. I mean, you know, and again, that comes out of true situations. The stuff that I was reading is that's exactly what was happening. These kids were being in court without parents, and they were being told basically, you know, getting them to waive their right to an attorney and say, you know what you did was wrong. Yeah, I know what I did was wrong. Okay, well, you know, let's fix this. And then, boom, all of a sudden, they're being shipped out to this detention facility. And the reality is that, you know, it's a true story, but it's almost so unbelievable that somebody didn't put an end to it sooner that it's almost,
yeah.
I almost had the reverse effect. I'm writing it in fiction, I had the problem of, are people really going to believe this? Because it seems so implausible, and that's that old saying, that old adage that, you know, fact is always more unbelievable than fiction.
No, I've, you know, dealt, like I said, I'm an educator, so I've dealt with difficult situations, and I know that there was a school in the Bronx called Spofford that was that this type of environment for kids. I'm not sure if the kids had children had to stay there or not, but there were different kinds of programs where they did send children, you know, students that were difficult at a time. So to think that this is not plausible, that it couldn't happen, yeah, it could. You send your child away to camp, and you don't even know what's going on there unless you monitor it. I mean, you get nervous. You know, you can send them anywhere. It could be just a 3-week camp. It could be a sports camp. And you basically, unless you're there with them or they have contact to you, you don't know. And some of these camps don't even allow cell phones, so that you've got to really be careful. And, you know, you could do all the research in the world, and you still can't be that careful. It's scary.
Yeah, and you know, it is a parent's worst nightmare. I mean, think of all the stories we've read recently, you know, the young girl who went to Aruba and disappeared.
That's
never
scary, I know.
Never to be seen or found again. The Amanda Knox story up here in Seattle. You know, she goes over to Italy to study. It's going to be the time of her life, and suddenly she's in the Italian judicial system being accused of murdering, a young girl and spends 4 years in prison, and the family's, you know, doing everything they can to try to get her out. It is a very scary situation, and I think that's what's resonating with a lot of readers is that this is scary because it could happen to almost any family.
Of course it could. And it doesn't matter whether you're rich or poor. It could definitely happen to anybody. What scared me was that the people that worked at this facility took pride in being mean. They didn't even care. That was like, they don't care, you know, hurting people, whatever. David and Tom were the friends, the parents, and they took a lot of abuse, and they took a lot of chance hurting. But why did they take a chance with this detective, Wade? He was sort of not who he says he was, right?
Pardon me?
The person that
Carl,
was this
yeah,
detective.
Carl Wade. That is, I don't want to get too deep into him
because
I don't
want to
give anything away to readers.
Yeah.
But, you know, you mentioned a good point about this whole concept of power being almost like an aphrodisiac for some people.
Yeah.
And, you know, some people are just mean-spirited. I'm a huge fan of Stephen King and The Green Mile. And the scary thing about The Green Mile is, you know, Paul Edgecombe in his older years is in a retirement home, and there's this orderly there, Brad, who's just mean. He's just a mean-spirited person. And that's the scary thing that you mentioned about these places is there is always the potential that you have somebody there that's there for the wrong reason. And they're mean-spirited, and they take pleasure in being mean towards other people. And you mentioned very, very poignantly what happened to the school bus driver. I mean, you know, as a parent, can you imagine if that was your child? I would be absolutely appalled. I mean, absolutely appalled that, you know, that was my child, that I didn't teach my child better than that. You know, it is scary, but there are people out there like that, and as a parent, you have to be ever diligent about where your child's going and what they're doing. I have children. My children are very, very good athletes. They've been invited to camps, you know, in Oregon, in Las Vegas, all over the place. And, you know, we will not do it unless we can go because it takes one mistake. You know, I have a daughter, and I know this is a little bit of a sexist statement, but, you know, because young boys can be abused just as much as young girls can.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, I have a daughter, and all I could think of is it takes one mistake on our part and one incident to, you know, to destroy her, to potentially give her a lifetime of nightmares and all kinds of problems. And so it's so important. And that's what I'm really actually very, very pleased that the review service have picked up on this. It's really, really important. I think for parents to have a conversation with their kids, sit down with their kids and say, listen, you know, you're going out tonight. And you got to understand that if there's going to be any drinking, you got to really be careful about the potential consequences, because, you know, not only do you have a potential consequence where you could get thrown in jail and get in a lot of trouble, but you have a potential consequence of dying, you know? And so you need to really think about the decisions that you make in your life, because one mistake can really result in drastic consequences. And again, my point was not to really, you know, I think you said it earlier. I mean, it's a scary book, but it's also it's an entertaining book. There's a lot of action in it. There's a lot of tension in it. There's a lot of stress in it, which is really what you want for a thriller. And I'm pleased that I was able to get the, you know, I'm pleased that in doing that and having a book that's a page turner, it also has a message that people are picking up on.
Yeah, I would think that anybody that really read the book would definitely get the message that, you know, about that you were trying to do. I mean, but there are a lot of people with reviews, in regard to reviews, that you just read the reviews and you know very, very well that they didn't read the book.
Yeah.
You can definitely tell. I mean, I got one for my last book about 3 weeks ago. It said, she wrote the word chill too many times. I want my money back from Kindle. And that was the only review that I got from this girl from Korea, and I called up Amazon. They took it off. They said she obviously didn't know what she was talking about. So, you know, people like that. You know, but when you're going to a party or kids are drinking like Jake drank or Tom, his friend drank, parents are supposed to be, isn't there supposed to be like a chaperone and the person who's making the party, aren't they supposed to be responsible to make sure that if somebody is drunk to get them home?
It just doesn't happen all the time, you know. And part of that is kids being kids, and part of that is parents trying to be friends instead of being parents.
My wife says that to me a lot
because, you know, I am very close to my kids, and we do a lot together because of the sports and everything. But, you know, she says, you know, you need to remember, you can be his friend, but you're his dad first. And that's every parent needs to remember that, because, you know, we've lived 50 years. We've experienced it. We've been there. I've done the stupid things. And I've said that to my son. I said, you know, I've done stupid things, and thank God, you know, the consequences were not as drastic as for some other people. But you need to understand, you know, the consequences. And we know more nowadays than we do, even when I was younger, okay? And we know now stuff. So, you know, my kids are very responsible kids, and I'm very blessed. Mm-hmm. But it's one of those situations where it just takes one mistake in the wrong place. Mm-hmm. You know, one mistake in the wrong place. And you know, True Luck, California, and Winchester County, in my book, could very easily be a foreign country. And that's sort of what I wanted it to be, because, you know, that's another thing that people don't realize. When you get in trouble in another country, there is no such thing as the United States Constitution to protect you. There is no such thing as the United States judicial system to protect you. You're not in that system anymore. And so I wanted a system where the law has failed. I did a trailer, a movie trailer, for the first time ever for a book, and it's on my website, which is just robertdugoni.com. And that trailer, that's exactly what it says. It says, you know, the judicial system has betrayed him, and the law won't help him. So what do you do in that circumstance? How far would you go to save your child? How far would you take it? If you thought your child's life was in danger, how far would you go to save him? And there's some really wonderful books and movies out there that test those limits. Blood Diamonds, for instance, comes to mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the African man who's going to get his son out of Sierra Leone. And it's really, I think it's an issue that every parent can relate to on one level or another.
I agree with you. But any parent that really cares about their child, I mean, like you said, your son or your daughter's going out, I say it to my nieces in Florida, my nephews, the three teens, and I said to them, you know what, when your mother asks you where you're going and to call and to say where you are, you know, back and forth, and just say I'm here or I'm on my way back, that's important. And it doesn't really matter where you live at this particular point. At night, kids should not be walking out by themselves.
No, they
should be walking in groups. I mean, I lived in the South Bronx growing up, and it didn't dawn on me. We didn't have cell phones. You know, my mother didn't get me a phone. And I would walk at night by myself, and it didn't dawn on me that, you need to be very, very careful because you're a girl and you're by yourself. and was one incident waiting for a group of my friends where this young man came over to me, and I just pretended to be crazy. And I was making up words and whatever, and I scared him. I literally scared him in 47 different languages. He just looked at me and ran away. And my friends were coming, and I kept saying things in every language I could possibly translate to. And they looked at me like, oh, he was whatever he was. And I just said, I don't speak English in 7 languages, whatever. And he just sort of got scared. But you can't go out in the dark by yourself, I mean, and you just really, kids need to be careful, adults need to be careful. I think it's a Bronx thing that even when I walk in the morning by myself, and I don't live in the Bronx anymore, if I hear somebody's footsteps behind me, I'll walk to the side.
Yeah, sure. Well, it doesn't matter being conscious, just being smart, you know?
Yeah, you have to be. And kids need to know that they have to be smart. They definitely have to know that they have to be smart. But they don't, and sometimes they think it's, you know, you're spying on them or something. So who is Eileen Fisher, and how did she manage to help them or not help them?
I'm sorry, I missed it. Who?
Who is Eileen Fisher?
Eileen Fisher, I'm drawing a blank.
Maybe I have the wrong character. Well, how did things come and turn around? Yeah, I'm trying to think about it. Yeah. Yeah, how did things turn around for them? How did they finally? How did David and Tom finally get things done? And who is Father Allen? How did his words ring in his ear? I'm sort of like I have an echo here all of a sudden.
Oh, I'm sorry. Father Allen is Sloan doesn't really have any religion. He was raised without a religion. He was raised in foster homes, but because he was married to Tina and Tina was Catholic, he began to go to church just simply because he wanted to see what faith was about. And he meets this young Catholic priest who's kind of a cool guy, you know. And I had some very cool Catholic priests in my youth, you know, very just cool guys, good guys, normal type of guys. And so Father Allen is this young Catholic priest, but he's also very, very well trained in a lot of the counseling and stuff that some priests are. And he becomes sort of Sloan's conscience for him. And he's been in a couple books now, and he's the person that says to Sloan, you know, this is who you are, and this is why you're doing what you're doing. And in this book, what he says to Sloan, and it turns out very poignant, is he says, you're not going to be able to waltz into a courtroom and fix this. Now, what Sloan thinks he's saying to him is that the judicial system's not going to work. But what he's really saying to him is, to fix a relationship with someone you love requires change. You need to change. And if you want to fix your relationship with your son, then it's going to take a heck of a lot more than getting him out of trouble with the law. It's going to require hours of rebuilding the relationship that you had with him of trust. And that's kind of who Father Allen is. He's sort of the book's conscience a little bit. And that's difficult for Sloan. But he is that character, and I've liked him, and I'd like to actually bring him back a little bit more in some future books, but it just the timing just hasn't been right yet.
Well, I think you should bring them all back. And in your next book, are you going to have Jake, and is he going to learn any more lessons, or is he going to accept? Well, he's got two fathers. He's got Frank, and he's got his real and he was his real father, and he's got David, who's his stepfather, right?
Yeah. Sloan. I have a great idea for our next book. I never like to talk about it. It's like sort of this, you don't want to lose the karma, the mojo out of it. But I have a great idea for the next book. Really, I mean, I'm really, really excited. I hope I get to write it. I just think it's a terrific idea. It would take Sloan out of his comfort zone again. So Jake would be in it peripherally. But Jake will now be living with Sloan because Jake will be old enough to make these decisions. And so Jake will be living with Sloan.
Are you going to bring back the character from the other book?
Yes. There's characters coming back from the other book. I won't say which ones. I have kind of
That's why I didn't say it. Yeah.
Yeah, I have a two-book idea that I'd really like, and it's really a continuation of the series, which is what I'm looking for. So there's this first idea, which I want to pitch, and then I have this next idea, which would be really, really scary, bringing back a character from a prior book. So I hope I get to do it. Fingers crossed, and we'll see where it takes me.
Well, I would imagine that they took all of your other books, that they would definitely, you know, take the next one too. I can't imagine that they wouldn't.
What do you hope? It's an interesting time in the business for everybody.
Yeah, it's hard.
Publishers are trying to figure things out. Writers are trying to figure things out. And a lot of it depends upon numbers and how many books you're selling and whether your numbers are going up or not going up and all those kind of things. And, you know, it's one of those things that I can't really worry about. I like I said, I just try to write the best books I can. The reviewers seem to really love them. This book in particular seems to be, you know, really catching people's attention. And I hope that translates into sales and the opportunity to continue to do what I love. So,
well, I posted it everywhere, and
I appreciate it.
Yeah, I do. I get a lot of people read what I write, believe it or not. They actually do. I got
a lot
of reaction. Yeah, I know you do. You do? I have.
Yes,
I'm all over Facebook, but I have my own review site called Reviewing Your Own Book. And
okay.
I started it about a month ago because I was bored and I wanted to do something different. And I've got over 135 wonderful people that asked to join my site, but there is a stipulation. You cannot write anything nasty, you can't pan a book, and you can't post a review that's bad.
Yeah,
it's a positive site for positive reviews. You could post your link, you could post your books, you can post your events, you can post your blog and how to get in touch with you, you can post anything you want, but you can't, and you can post a 4-star review, but you cannot post something that says, I hated the book, or the author doesn't know what they're doing, and you can't post anything negative. That's my only thing. And I've deleted people's comments when they do that. And you can't write anything with bad words because I don't like it.
So, well,
and I've got, and everybody agrees, I've got 11 people that are reviewing for me besides myself that have on the site, 11 people, so that if people want their books reviewed, they just go to my Facebook thing, ask for a review on reviewing your book, ask to join if you're an author, and basically there are 11 people that you know will read the books. I won't read PDF because my eyes bug out, forget it, but they will. Everybody else will. And I've got reviewers that I think they're really good, otherwise they wouldn't be reviewing, and we all do it for nothing, people. I just, you know, want them to know we don't get paid because that would ruin the fun of doing it. I do everything.
Well, I tell you, as authors, we sure appreciate it, so God love you.
Well, you know what, I just hope I get your books before they come out, like I got this one, Conviction. I got that one way before it came out. It was nice. It was a surprise in the mail. And it was funny, like I said, I got your book on Red Room. When I found you, I saw that was recommended by someone that read it on the Red Room, which I am a member of Red Room, and I've been, you know, getting a little bit more active there. And I said, okay, let me see if I can get this book. You can't always get them.
Mm-hmm.
I was excited today because I didn't expect it. I got Lincoln Child's new book, Third Gate.
Oh, great.
And I don't, yeah, well, I didn't get it from him. I got it from, because he emails me, but he doesn't answer his emails. So I got it from Doubleday. I was, like, really excited. I go, oh, my God, still can't get James Patterson, but I gave up on that one. Forget it. But and I tried to get Michael Connelly, and he saw on Facebook that I asked to read his book, and he told me to go through his publicist, but the first one sent the fifth witness, the second one just, they didn't answer. So there's nothing I can do about that. I have been doing okay, considering I'm just starting out and trying.
Well,
I
you know, Michael
first...
Connelly and I are competing for a very prestigious award. He and I are competing for the Harper Lee Award through the American Bar Association Journal, and the public has a chance to vote on it. And his book that's up is The Fifth Witness, and my book that's up is Murder One. So it's been kind of exciting to be paired with him in a contest like that.
Well, I voted for yours. I just like.
Well, thank you.
I certainly did, a couple of times. But I have a whole bunch of emails. Nope, I did. I got the link when you sent it, and I have to thank you for what you did for my nephew, Jake. He was just absolutely so thrilled. I said, guess what? And he looked at me and said, oh, my God, a famous author. Well, he's a reader.
Oh, great.
So,
great. Well,
yeah,
I'm glad. It's a terrific cause that he was doing, so I was happy to participate.
Yeah, he raised over $2,600 at 12 years old by himself, and I was very proud
That's
of
great.
Him.
He
played very well, but he didn't win, and he was upset. But he played this weekend, and for the first time yesterday, he was playing baseball. And my brother, you know, calls once in a while. He's busy, so he actually called in during the show yesterday on my cell phone. And he was yelling, "Yeah, that's my sister out there, my aunt." So, and he was trying to tell me that he was playing baseball. It was hysterical. He's a riot. So, tell me something, Jake and Tom. Do you think they learned anything as a result of this?
Oh yeah. Yeah, I think it's one of those life situations where, it's a life-changing moment. You know, we all have epiphanies in life or life-changing moments. And I think for a kid like that, that goes through that type of a trauma, the shock system alone, you can't come out of it on the other side unchanged. And I, you know, given who he was when he went in and the base, the foundation that he had, I think when he comes out, he's learned a very valuable lesson. Hard lesson, but a valuable lesson.
Well, I think that if he could see it in a video before, as it was happening to him, before it happened, I think maybe he would have thought twice about what he did.
Yeah, and that's how it is for everybody. You know, we all make mistakes in life, and it's hindsight. We look back and say, gee, I wish I hadn't done that. Our job as parents is to try to educate our kids through our own mistakes to say, don't make the same mistakes I made. And you know, hopefully we can do that.
Well, even throughout the novel, despite the fact that he didn't want Sloane's help, yet he knew that he was the only one that could help him. In the back of his mind, he kept saying, you know, he's going to help me, it's going to be okay, he's going to help me, it's going to be okay. And no matter what Jake did to push him away, I guess he's really lucky that Sloane didn't say, the heck with you, you're not my son anyway, it doesn't really matter.
Right. No, that's that whole parent bond. I mean, hopefully you've established a strong enough bond with your children that you realize that when they're pushing you away, they're really crying out for help.
But how many parents realize that?
It's hard. You know, it's hard. Everybody comes from different situations and their own different backgrounds. And yeah, you know, there's that old saying from that movie Parenthood that, you know, anybody in the world can have a child, but to have a dog, you have to go down and get a dog license. You know what I mean? It almost seems reversed. You know that, but there's no prerequisites or no training, right? Anybody in the world can have a child, but having a child doesn't make you a parent. And unfortunately, you know, it doesn't always work out that way.
That is true. So, if you could say which one of your characters besides Sloane is the one that you really like the best,
Tom Moy is a great character. Yeah, Tom Moy is a great character, and one of the reasons why I really brought him back in a big way in this book is because so many of my readers had asked, you know, are you going to get Tom Moy back? Are you going to get Tom Moy back? He's just a great character. He's just a great, I mean, character's a good word for him. He's funny, he's witty, he's got great instincts, he's dogged, he's got a great sense of humor. So he's a very good character. He's a very strong character. And I really wanted him to be a part of this.
Yeah, well, he was. It was interesting how the two of them managed to get. Well, I won't say anymore. Well, I'm going to ask different types of questions now. More likely the publishing kind. Okay. When you post your reviews, or besides Amazon, and this is like a hard question, for new authors especially. And for someone like myself that reviews books and posts them like in about 30, 40 different places, what would you think is the one place that most people would see the reviews? And for a new author to get their book in a bookstore, because it's really hard, how do you get them to notice your book on Amazon? Yours they're going to notice. On Amazon or any other site, which site besides Amazon would you think would be the best place to post a review? And I don't think it's Barnes & Noble.
No, you know, that is a really tough question, because I think in reality what it is it's almost better if you can find a very well-read blogger to read your book and blog about your book. Somebody that has, you know, 100,000 readers on their blog site. That is really the best way in this day and age, is to get the bloggers talking about and blogging about your book. I honestly don't know how much people put into reading Amazon and Barnes & Noble, because a lot of people think that Amazon reviews are all stilted, people that were writers go out and get all their friends and family to post reviews, which is crazy. You know, that's not always the case. I think you have to go to the really strong bloggers. People such as yourself, Fran. I mean, people such as on, you know, Red Room post some pretty good reviews. People that don't have access to Grind. You know, a lot of people that go on Amazon and Barnes & Noble have access to Grind for whatever reason.
I agree with you.
Yeah, I think you need the bloggers, the book lovers, people who really love books and who are blogging about them. And then you say, okay, That's I got to get that person to read my book because they can help spread the word.
Well, I have my blog is on in 77 different places. My WordPress blog is under my nickname that my sister used to call me for whatever reason, which we won't discuss, Gabina49@WordPress.com. I have a lot of followers that people find me out of nowhere, you know, to follow my reviews, or they'll follow me on Goodreads, which seems to be one of the places that people read everything that I write also.
Right.
One of the sites that I just joined, and I got a lot of action on your review, and I'll repost it again, is Cafe Libri, which is lunch.com. They read everything I write. They read everything that I write, and they even have like a book of the month club, whatever. I don't join into the discussions, but I post everything there, and I started out as ranked as 200 and something. I'm down to number 39 in review as a reviewer.
Fabulous.
So,
yeah,
I don't
That's
go
great.
For the numbers or whatever, yeah, but they read, there are people there that actually read, and they do comment on every single thing that I write or anyone else writes. I just got hired for compensation to work for Hillcrest Media as the media coordinator for blog tours. So I'm going to do my very first one, with an author, and they're not paying me, people, so don't think that. One of the people that I'm working with, he's going to be my publicist. He's going to help me publicize my next book that's coming out. So I'll take the publicity and the publicist rather than having to pick at the money, because I think it's worth more to me to get all of the press releases and all of that. But if you had to pick which blog site, I mean, WordPress is fantastic because people read it, but I have never seen a blogger with so many, you know, that many followers. I know that there were people that every time I put your review out, which I did the other day, it was retweeted 7 times by a whole bunch of people.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it was.
That's great.
It was retweeted. Everything that I write is retweeted by Tim Greeton and a whole bunch of other people that automatically see whatever I write and it gets retweeted 6 or 7 times a day. There are people in England that read my... There's a publishing company, Sparkling, that listens to my radio show because I interviewed Sally Spedding. So they'll retweet everything that I write. So I don't know how helpful that is.
Well, if there's anybody out there in the United Kingdom... I just got an email the other day. How come my book's on in the United Kingdom? If there's anybody out there in the United Kingdom who really wants to read my book, tell them to go out there and pound the pavement and get me a publisher in England. That's one place... In Europe, I swear I cannot get a publisher to pick out my book. So,
well, you know what? I work with
great.
Sparkling. I work with Sparkling Publishing Company. Seriously, they're a publishing company in England, and they send me their stuff all the time. If you want their email, I can give it to you. They're a small publishing house, and they publish books based pretty much like what you write.
That's
out of the ordinary. And Sally Spedding's book, Cold Remains, was an interesting book that scared me, too. And I'm getting her next one is Malediction, which is about Germany and the Nazis and stuff like that, and hopefully Fran will understand it. So if you want, I can put you in touch with Anna, who is...
Well, that'd be great.
I'm serious, who is the publisher. You know, doing this, I've met so many people.
But
put you in the same email after the show, and I will tell her that, you know, you're a New York Times bestselling author in New York, in America, and maybe if she can't do it, maybe somebody else can. Because why not?
Yeah, that would be great. It's funny. It's one country I can't really get into it, and I should love to get my books over to England because I do get a lot of hits on my Google websites and stuff from England. So you never know.
Well, I will put you in touch with Anna because she loves me because I do her favors all the time. And the books that she sends me are basically books like The Conviction and stuff like that. So maybe they will actually take it. That would be really cool. And then I could say, well, gee, I did something right for a change. Okay. So if you could kill off a character in any one of your books that you didn't kill off, would you kill off anybody?
I'm going to be much more discerning. And I made a decision in Bodily Harm, like I said, because I think it freed me up to write the next 4 or 5 books. And I'm really, I don't regret the decision I made in that book. However, when you're building a series, it's very important to your readers that series has characters in there that continue forward. And so, you know, I always tell people, it's fiction, people. I'll kill anyone. And that's one of the things I did in Bodily Harm. Really, it was a great setup for The Conviction. I won't say what it was, but there were some people in reading The Conviction that really gasped when they got to a certain point in the book because they had to sit and really wonder whether I would have done what I just did, and And because of what I did in Bodily Harm, and because, you know, they know that I'm an untrustworthy author when it comes to my characters, that they had to really sit there and go, oh, my God, did he just do that? Did he really just do that? But that's sort of the fun of reading, I think, is not being 100% sure where a book's going or what an author's going to do. But I'm going to be very discerning about who dies from this point forward. I'm not saying I won't kill someone, but you know, I want to be discerning about it.
Well, you can't kill David Sloan because you just can't do that. You can't kill Sloan because what would be the point of having the Sloan series without Sloan, right?
Right. No.
And I'm just wondering if maybe Jake is going to want to follow in his footsteps ever and become a
lawyer
too.
There's a possibility. Yeah, no, there's definitely a possibility.
I'm writing these down with my pen, saying to myself, okay, you know, I like this kid. He was a lot nicer in Murder One. He was a lot different in Murder One. And then he sort of like did an about face in this particular one. And when I got the blurb from the publicist and I say, well, oh my God, this is really good. Mm-hmm. I have to tell you, Jessica is really great. Jessica Roth, she's
great.
Amazing.
Yes, she is.
She's amazing. But because through her, believe it or not, I've gotten to other authors in Simon and Schuster, which is even better, which is great. So I've gotten some interesting books, and of course I can't seem to get Mary Higgins Clark. Ariel did send me her publicist, but she doesn't answer. So, okay, what can I say? So the goals of your book, you do have a message in every single one of the books. So as a result, not just Jake, what do you hope kids are going to learn after they read this? Because I really think that teenage boys need to use this, and this would be really great for discussion groups in guidance counselors in school.
Yeah, I think so too. My hope is that it makes them choose wisely. You know, it makes them think, stop and think about what they are about to do and the consequences that can result from it. Too often we make decisions and we don't consider the consequences of our decisions. And my hope is that, you know, if enough kids can read this book and start to read this book, that it does become an opportunity for teachers, professionals, parents, whatever, to say to their kids what I say to my kids, which is, you know, it takes a lifetime to build a reputation. It takes one dumb mistake to tear it down. So be very careful about the decisions you make. Just think about what you do. And the hard part is that, you know, how alcohol and drugs, you know, color our perception, color our ability to make the correct decisions. But that in and of itself is a decision that young kids have to make, you know. Do you really want to do that? Do you really want to put yourself in that kind of a vulnerable situation? If you are, do you have friends that will take care of you so that you don't get yourself in trouble?
Why do these kids, and I saw it on the doctors a while ago, and they tried to convince these girls not to do it, but I got the feeling by the end of the show they were still going to do it. Why do they take 21 shots when they're 21 and that could kill you? And they even showed this kid was on there that said he went into a coma. They showed him in the hospital with a breathing tube. They showed these girls what happened. They explained what happened, and yet I got the feeling at the end that they were going to do it anyway.
Yeah, you know, I think part of it is when you're that young, you feel invincible, right? You feel invincible mm-hmm. when you're young. I mean, you're not going to get hurt. You're young. You're vibrant. You're strong. You don't see your own mortality. But yeah, you're right. I mean, you know, any type of ingestion of any type of drug, you know, including alcohol, you have the potential, right, to really end up in a very bad situation. And it's a difficult dilemma for parents. I mean, that's why I think, you know, my mother never went to sleep when we were out. You know, she was always awake. And we always had that in the back of our minds when we were out. You know, my mom's awake. When I get home, she's going to be awake. And, you know, but we had that. My mother made it very clear to us. And I think, you know, I think parents just need to be aware of what their children are doing, where they're at, who their friends are. You know, we stay in touch now with cell phones much better than we ever did when I was young. You know, I'll email my son or I'll call my son. It'll be a Friday night, you know, and I'll say, where are you at? Who's with you? What are you doing? You know, what time are you guys gonna get home? You know, and just, you know, or if he's going to spend a night at a friend's house, you know, my wife will pick up the phone. She'll call the other parent, the other mother. Hey, just wanted to, Joe says he's spending the night. You know, wanted to make sure that was okay and that what they're doing, what they're saying they're doing, you know. It's just a matter of staying in contact and being smart. Now, it's not to say I'm the greatest parent in the world. I make my own share of mistakes. But, you know, it's one of those things where it doesn't come with an owner's manual. You know, you got to kind of learn on the job. But I think the most important thing is just staying in contact with your kids and knowing where they are and who their friends are and what they're doing.
I agree with you, because growing up, my father weighed 400 pounds. So I came home from a date, which was rare, and he would be sitting on the chair. He would be sitting on the chair when I walked in, seriously. And he would say to the guy, I'm going to walk out of the room. You've got 5 minutes before you leave. And that was it. Those are the rules. I mean, my grandfather lived with us for a while when my grandmother died. And a young man walked in, and he looked at him, and he said, you can go down the block to take her out to eat. Her sister's coming with you, which was true, and you're not coming back again because you're not right for her. And
oh, wow.
I grew up tough. They were like, forget it. If I was going to be, and kids today should do this too, if you're going to be 5 minutes late, call. And and we didn't have cell phones. My mother didn't have phones, so you had to find a payphone or from your friend's house. And I'll never forget going to a party with a group of girls. It was a birthday party. And I walked into the house, and these were friends from school. And you're right, one dumb mistake could really get you.
Yeah.
They were smoking. They were like 13 and 14. They were drinking. And I called my mother, and I said, I know it's like 9 o'clock at night, and I'm going to walk home. Just listen for me and watch me as I come down the street. I left. They were playing spin the bottle, and they were doing all sorts of things. And she said to me, what made you? I said, because that's not who I am. I'm with those are the wrong people. There were a group of girls from school that I knew, and they invited me to a party. And the thought of drinking or smoking, forget that. I would never do that. Just the smell of tobacco makes me sick. I guess it's who you are. And my parents never said to me, you know, you can't do this or that. Or they just sort of teach you, this is not what you want to do. This is not who you want to be. And you're right. One dumb mistake could actually ruin your whole life.
Yeah, true.
I just want to take 1 minute to announce the show for next month before I forget, so then I can ask you more questions. Okay, we have on July 18th at 3, Dr. Ellen Ruderman, Chasing the Red Car. She's going to talk about the McCarthy era in her book. And we have NFL superstar from the Denver Broncos who wrote Winds of Redemption, Harvey Goodman. If anybody's heard of him, he's a football player, educator, and now he's an author. And Harvey's going to be on the show that day. I'm like sort of excited. I'd never interviewed a football player before, but that's going to be fun. And an author. The next day, we're going to interview five New York Times romance novelists. Believe it or not, Laurie Foster, Brenda Jackson, Verna DePaul, Catherine Mann, and Jules Bennett. And the reason why we're talking about their book is because the authors are donating every penny of the proceeds of Love Bites to the Animal Adoption Foundation of Hamilton, Ohio, a charitable organization. So I'm reading all of their books. I get to review all five. And followed by Margaret, the president of the American Mystery Writers of America, Margaret McLean. And her book is Under Oath. So that should be interesting. And hopefully in we're going to have August 16th, we're going to have Iris Johansson. She just emailed me. Yes, they're coming on. And in September, we're going to have Tess. And when is your next book coming out? Because I want to make sure I have a date for you.
My next book will not be out probably until next June.
Oh, okay. Well,
I got a ways to go. I'm 1 year right now.
You're 1 year right now.
Yeah, one year.
One a year. And it takes how long to write that whole book, that whole year?
It takes me, you know, because I do a lot of other things still. Yeah, it's about a year long process. But I'm hoping I'm on tour now, and once this tour settles down, I'm hoping to dig into writing the next book and moving forward. So,
I'll remind you.
I come out every June.
I'll remind you if you need, you know, a little reminder here.
We'll get it to you.
I know. I'm not worried about that. I didn't read Bodily Harm, though.
Well, you'll have to read that one. Then you'll know what's the background for what's happened in these last two books. So
I'm gonna have
you let me know, and I can get it to you.
Okay, I will, because I will email you later. Yeah, I need to get that, definitely.
Yeah.
I have to read the first one. Because I only have a stack of 30 books in front of me, you know. One more. No, they were laughing last week because I read 10 books The postman literally last Monday dropped 10 books at my doorstep, and they're all done. And,
oh, wow.
Yeah, I get eye strain a lot, so sometimes I'm looking at the computer and I'm going, like, get away, I can't stand it anymore. Yeah. So where can everybody get your books before we say goodnight and close and everything like that?
Yeah, thank you again for having me on. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
The best place to go to my website. Just go to www.robertdugoni.com, and you'll learn a lot about me and a lot about my books and a lot about where you can get my books. And, you know, if you have e-readers, there's ways that you can get them there. You can even get them from some of your favorite independent bookstores, which I always like to support. But there's mm-hmm. links on there to get the books. Or you can also look on my website for my events, and tours. I'm leaving for Dallas next Tuesday. I just got home from Phoenix. I'll be in Dallas. There's actually an open event for the public, so if you're in Dallas. So, there's a lot of different ways, but the best place is always to go to my website, go to robertdugoni.com, and you can get a lot of information. And with that, Fran, thank you. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you so much, but when you come to New York, you have to tell me.
My pleasure. I'll get you a copy of Bodily Harm, and stay in touch, and I'll look through your email, and great show as always.
Thank you so much, and I'm going to put you in touch with Anna right now. And everyone, we will be back on, like I said, July 18th with Harvey Goodman and Dr. Ellen Rutterman, and the next day with a big show with the authors of Love Bites, Laurie Foster, Brenda Jackson, Verna DePaul, Catherine Mann, and Jules Bennett, and Mark McLean, the president of the American Mystery Writers Show of America. And we have our very favorite, Iris Johansson. She just emailed me. They just emailed me August 16th. At 3. And on that note, Sandra, thank you so much. Everyone that's listening, thank you so much. And we'll see you next time. Have a great night and bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.